Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Mark and Simon have taken the whole of August off. I'm sure if they'd realised The Last Airbender was coming out this week, they'd have booked with greater care. So it's hello to Five Live's answer to Pearl and Dean, or should that be Torval and Dean, Boyd and Floyd. Boyd Hilton, Nigel Floyd, what have you been watching this week?
Well, as you mentioned, The Last Airbender, I think audience anticipation for this film has reached levels of hysteria. Not sure what else is there.
That was an example of the hysteria there.
Exactly. I was hysterical whilst watching it, but I have calmed down a little since then, I have to say. Black Dynamite, which is a fantastic parody of all those blaxploitation movies from the 70s.
We've also got Nicolas Cage in The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is from the people who brought you the National Treasure movies.
And we've got a couple of foreign language movies, actually. The Secrets in Their Eyes and Le Refuge. And for our younger listeners, Tinkerbell and the Great Fairy Rescue.
Oh, yes. And we really want your reviews, too. We'll do the top 10 shortly, and we'll try and get as many of your reviews into that. Text 85058 or email at mail.bbc.co.uk. Now, we're also going to have in the studio a special guest, the Bond composer David Arnold. We'll be talking film soundtracks. He's putting on a sort of film composer version of Live Aid and hosting a special screening of Psycho to raise money for Care International. This is what people will get at the Psycho screening. So we've been asking you, the listeners, to tell us your favourite and worst film soundtracks, and you've been answering already. Steve Burry, St. Edmunds, best soundtrack, About a Boy, no question, it's a badly drawn boy one. From Craig in Loughborough, The Lost Boys has to be up there with best film soundtrack, still sends a shiver down my spine when I listen to it. William in Glasgow's gone for Where Eagles Dare. Jamie in Nottingham says, worst film soundtracks, anything by John Carpenter for his own films. Cheesy synth music. Pity, because the films are great. He should just have employed Vangelis. Please keep them coming. And over the last few weeks, we've been trying to get to know Boyd and Floyd's film taste. So we'll ask you the same question today. Boyd Hilton, the greatest movie soundtrack of all time.
Can I just say that John Carpenter's music for Halloween is brilliant? I mean, I think that's an outrageous comment. I mean, everyone's entitled to their opinion. But my favourites, well, we heard the Psycho music there, done by Bernard Herrmann, who was just a genius and did many, many Hitchcock films. North by Northwest, which is quite similar to that music, the opening titles, to be fair. It was a bit of a one-trick pony, maybe. Good trick. It was brilliant. But he also did some amazing Martin Scorsese soundtracks. The film isn't brilliant, but Cape Fear has the most brilliant, spooky theme, which kind of runs all the way through. It's just like three or four notes, which is fantastic. And Taxi Driver is one of the most... This kind of captures the atmosphere of that film perfectly. Other recent ones I wanted to mention: Johnny Greenwood's soundtrack for There Will Be Blood, Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead, which was outrageously not allowed to be entered for the Oscar race that year
because all the music here wasn't original.
Well, and also it wasn't long enough, so you have to have a certain amount of original music on the soundtrack to make it into the ridiculous reasons they give to be able to be eligible for an Oscar. And even though it's one of the best soundtracks of recent years and fits that film perfectly, outrageously wasn't allowed to. It would have won the Oscar, I'm sure, if it had been allowed to take part. And the other thing I wanted to mention quickly is Hans Zimmer's music for Inception, which Simon and Mark talked about a few weeks ago, which is an incredible contribution to that film. The kind of big, huge, big blast of music that strikes when an important thing happens in Inception is so important to the film.
And features Johnny Marr.
Brilliant.
Nigel? Yeah, it's interesting. I'd like to sort of bring another note into it, as it were, no pun intended, which is that there are after Martin Scorsese, there are those soundtracks which are more like a jukebox soundtrack. Now, that's kind of, in a way, easier, because all you've got to do is get the found music and put it on, make it appropriate. But Martin Scorsese, of course, is the master of that. I mean, he did terrific things. I mean, the scene in Mean Streets, I talked about Mean Streets before, but the scene in Mean Streets where Robert De Niro's character comes into the bar and it's all the red light, Harvey Keitel standing at the bar, and you hear the Stones song come on.
Gimme Shelter?
Yeah.
No, it's... God.
It's normally Gimme Shelter if it's...
He's used it twice, isn't he? Yeah, or maybe even three times.
And I think that that's the thing. If you can get the right thing, and Stanley Kubrick's the other one who does it, of course, you know, Clockwork Orange. I mean, one of the problems for me is, well, that when I hear Clockwork Orange and I hear the songs that are used in that, for instance, Singing in the Rain, I think of the scenes in Clockwork Orange rather than Singing in the Rain. And it's odd because the process in Clockwork Orange whereby he is forced to watch very violent films and associate them with his favourite bits of music, that's what happens to you when you watch. Yeah, exactly.
You've been brainwashed.
When you watch those Stanley Kubrick films now, for instance, you can't hear those Strauss waltzes now without seeing the scenes from 2001. It's like he's got inside your head.
Please 85058 your best and worst film soundtracks or your questions for Dave Arnold. In fact, well, I'm sure we'll put that to him, the whole idea about the jukebox soundtrack against a scored soundtrack. John in Oxford says, by far the worst ever film soundtrack, Queen's appalling effort on Flash Gordon. In fact, they didn't do the whole soundtrack. The professional bits were scored by Howard Blake. Gordon's alive.
I love that song. Flash is brilliant. The rest of the soundtrack, yeah, I could do without.
Not so good. Anyway, let's move on. Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Willis, Lundgren, Lee. The Expendables had its UK premiere this week. It opens in the US tonight, the UK next Friday when we'll be reviewing it. I spoke to the writer-director, Sly Stallone, on the red carpet on Monday at the premiere. He told me Jean-Claude Van Damme, who said no to this film, could have a part in the sequel, but only if he can beat Jet Li in a fight. And before the premiere, I managed to catch up with the British actor, who's Jason Statham, who's the, one of the main stars of the film. At 37, by far the youngest of the cast, he plays Lee Christmas, who joins a band of mercenaries hired to overthrow a South American dictator. Before we hear from him, here's a taste of Statham and Stallone in action.
Drop your guns!
I'll take the four on the left.
Why don't you take the two on the right and leave the rest alone?
You should take the two on the right. You're not that fast anymore.
Anything faster is light.
We'll see.
Bullets go faster than blades.
Bring me money here, now!
You want the money? Go get it.
What's that?
In a text.
Excuse me?
Get out!
Yeah, call that a tie.
Come on, keep dreaming.
So, Jason Statham, how much of an honour to be part of this cast?
It's a big one, as you can imagine, yeah. Sly Stallone, Bruce Willis, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Mickey Rourke, come on.
These must have been the guys you watched growing up.
I mean, Rocky and Rambo are one of the, well, the two of the most influential sort of action franchise I've ever seen, you know, I mean, they don't come much bigger and better than that. And, you know, the same with all Bruce Willis's movies and Arnold. So, you know, these are the action heroes that we all know and have, you know, carved their place into, you know, the Cinema Hall of Fame. And, you know, Sly's, you know, put everybody together. So it's the first time we'll see all of those three names mentioned on screen in a scene together. So he's done something quite unique there.
So many boys, when they're growing up, will have that VHS cassette they'll watch again and again and again off a certain film. Did you have one?
You know, I think First Blood was a great film for me. And the Rocky, to you know, those two were the most significant Sly films. The first is always the best, I feel. Yeah.
How did you feel then when you got the call? In fact, how did it work? Did Sly phone the mobile?
He didn't have my mobile, no, but there was a call and he wanted to have a bite to eat in a hotel over in Beverly Hills. And, you know, you get the call from Stallone. It's like, what?
You go.
He wants to see me? So, yeah, you rush there and, he was, you know, you have a big expectation of how somebody is going to be, especially when they're such a big star. Usually it can be disappointing, but it was quite the opposite. You know, he's a very straight, regular, sort of normal chap with a great sense of humour. And I thought, you know, the chance to work with him is, you don't even have to tell me what the part's about. I mean, anyway, you know.
How much is the film serious? How much does it have its tongue in the cheek?
That's a question for you lot to answer when you watch it. You know, I think what he does, he makes the films for the people, and I think that's something that people tend to get lost in. A lot of directors, they're doing it for themselves, but he likes the appreciation, no doubt. And you know, he likes stories about sort of people that people can relate to, and you know, it's all in the name of entertainment. And if he can manage that, then he's done his job.
The 80s action hero. I mean, you're mentioning all the names. These are the men who were above cinemas throughout a decade. It's kind of changed now, hasn't it? It's the high concept movie rather than the big name stars we have in cinema now.
Well, you know, Sly's harking back to what he knows best as action films should get made, and that's, you know, shooting big stunts through the camera. CG is a thing that doesn't get him on the hook, and, you know, if he shoots a big sequence and it can be enhanced a little bit with the technology of today, then he's not going to say, no, I'm not going to use that, but you'll feel that most of the stunts are all in camera. And that's just something he's done throughout his career, and he just keeps doing it. It's the way he makes movies. And I think people, that's why people respond to his films, because they, you know, there's something about seeing a guy, you know, doing something for real. That's the difference.
But the star vehicle doesn't seem to exist to the same extent now.
Yeah, the movie has overtaken the big star.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. It saves the studios millions and millions of dollars. If they can make the movie the star, they just have, you know, they take the cream of all the revenues, and they don't have to pay their big salaries. So that's one of the reasons.
Because you don't have that many contemporaries doing the kind of action movies that you do.
There's a few people out there, don't you worry about that.
So in 20 years' time, if Jason Statham was getting his Expendables together.
If I'm still around, if I'm not busted up and in a different state than I am already. Yeah, we'll see.
How much training did everyone have to do for this film?
You have to be ready for a Stallone film. And, you know, there's a certain skill I had to learn with a knife, so I got stuck into that. And, there's no way you can turn up, you know, out of shape and, you know, half hungover.
And do you think the Expendables will be a franchise, or is this a one-off?
That depends. I mean, the opportunity lies in whether people want to go and see another one. So let's see how this one does, eh?
And very finally, what was the absolute highlight of your filming?
I don't know, just seeing the end result, seeing Sly and Schwarzenegger and Willis in this particular scene. I just think it's worth anyone's £10, I can tell you that.
That is Jason Statham. Floyd and Boyd's views on The Expendables will be revealed on this show next Friday. Let's move in to some emails, actually. We've been getting a lot of emails coming in, and people starting to give us names. Dear Chuck, Sloth and Mouth. I think that's a nice Goonies reference. I was fortunate enough to go to a preview screening of The Last Airbender, tagline, Air will move, but not for much longer, last night. The acting was beyond hammy. Dev Patel was startlingly miscast. The plot was utterly nonsensical. Even though it was free, I want my money back. We'll get Boyd and Floyd's version on that later. Dear Boyd Bender, Floyd Bender and Colin. Don't know why I'm not a bender. I recently began watching Avatar The Last Airbender. That's the TV version of it. It's originally a Nickelodeon cartoon. Got through the first season before seeing M. Night Shyamalan's big screen version. I was braced for the worst by the poor reviews, but couldn't possibly expect the humourless exercise in franchise building that slapped me about the face and brain for 103 minutes. This is the last Airbender film you would make if you were drunk. I'm looking forward to the Last Airbender review sometime after 3 o'clock. Let's go through the top 10. At number 10, Gainsborough, which is 2 weeks in the top 10 now.
Yeah, nice, isn't it? I mean, a foreign language movie in the middle of summer. The usual wisdom is that you would release a film like this maybe in autumn, you know, September, October, a few more students around in the towns and stuff like that. But it's nice that it's a bit of counter-programming, I think it would be called in the trade, and it's worked very nicely.
And it did better than Coco Chanel and Igor Stravinsky, which we reviewed last week.
Yeah, just below at number 11, so it didn't quite make it into the top 10.
At number 9, The Twilight Saga Eclipse.
Yeah, it's now the third... It's the third film in the series, but it's the most successful film in the series. Quite right, because it's also the best one so far, I think. And I'm still waiting to go on my hot date with Simon Mayer, Mark Kermode, because I don't know if Simon's seen it yet. He went on holiday to America. Has he seen this film yet? Because he was desperate to see it, I guarantee you that.
Anything could have happened in August with and those boys. True. I ate Shrek Forever After.
Yes, which I've been avoiding, of course, but it's taken 30 million in this country alone. So it, in commercial terms, it was a good decision. Whether in aesthetic terms or artistic terms it was a good decision to make another one, I'm not entirely sure.
No, it was a good decision on your part not to see it.
Mm-hmm.
at 7, dropping quite quickly, the 18.
Yeah, I think they'll be disappointed with the box office for this. I mean, I think, you know, they're hoping it was going to be a big summer blockbuster. It hasn't quite performed that well. And I think that's maybe because word of mouth isn't that good, because it's a bit of a mess, to be honest. It's not, you know, the original series, great fun. This one, for me, it's incoherent.
At 6, The Karate Kid.
Yeah, Karate Kid, big surprise and a good surprise. I mean, both Boyd and I like this film. We think it's arguably better than the first, which everyone is complaining about my saying that the first one isn't as good as you remember. Having watched it on DVD, I'm standing by that position. But it was a nice surprise. What surprises me, however, is that it's down to number 6 already. It's only 2 weeks. I thought it would actually hold up much better.
But it is a massive box office this week. I mean, yeah, they've still taken over £1 million each at the box office.
Yeah, I think it's like the record for the amount of films that have taken £1 million in the box office in 1 week, or certainly it hardly ever happens. There's 7, I think, that have taken over £1 million.
And at number 5, Cats and Dogs 2, The Revenge of Kitty Galore.
Yes, the unnecessary sequel to the original Cats and Dogs film. The best thing about it is the opening title sequence, which is a spoof of the James Bond opening title sequences, and the music might even be a spoof of David Arnold music. I'm not sure if he's seen this film. He probably hasn't, if he's got any sense. But the whole thing is pretty much a James Bond spoof, and after the title sequence, it's downhill from there. It's not funny enough by any stretch of the imagination.
At number 4, it's Step Up 3D, and we've had an email in about this. Bobby in Sydney says, against my better judgment, I went to see a preview of Step Up 3D the other week. I have to say, I agree entirely with last week's review. The dance sequences were excellent, the dialogue magnificently hopeless. One of the best examples of this was when, as the romantic leads were considering leaving New York, the girl with the abs says to the guy with the pecs, "We could go anywhere," before slightly undermining the world of possibilities by adding, "Even California." But while the plot merely served to join the dots between the dance scenes, the film's overall tone was nice in that it managed to portray the kind of super cool urban world every teenager would want to be a part of. And for that, Step Up 3D surely deserves some credit.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny. It made us laugh anyway. I mean, we laughed a lot all the way through.
But then we are born from a beatbox.
Yes.
Or boombox.
Or boombox. Born from a boombox. That was definitely, for me, so far this year, your B-Fab, born from a boombox, worst line of dialogue so far.
Oh, that's
a game to play. But the dancing was pretty good, and the 3D wasn't bad.
And at number 3, Inception. Again, we've had a listener review of it. Dear, you had me at Voorhees and Newton's. Now, you had me at Jerry Maguire, Voorhees, Friday the 13th, which is today. Newton's, I'm clueless.
We don't know. No,
we're not there for that one.
This is going to be embarrassing. Someone's going to email in saying, oh, how dare you not get the reference to Newton's, but we have no idea what they're talking about.
Joseph Welsh, if you are there, you have beaten us with your dears. Or if anyone else knows what Newton's is, please let us know. And he's writing about Inception. After listening to the deluge of correspondence last week, I, like many others, made a trip to the local picture house to see Christopher Nolan's Inception. However, as I got to the ticket booth, I made a mistake in my ordering the ticket. For reasons I can't quite comprehend, I asked for one ticket to Redemption, please. Not only had I got the title wrong, I'd seemingly made up an entirely different film. Perhaps it was my subconscious desperately yearning for salvation, perhaps not. Whatever the reason, I would like to know if any other listeners have made comparable mistakes whilst buying tickets. Incidentally, I found the film to be thrilling and engaging, and thought the plot, though it took some keeping up with, it was worth following, and I followed it better than any of the Bourne trilogy. Inception at 3, back up the charts.
Yeah, incredible box office performance. £26 million here, heading for £250 million in America. I mean, this is one of the huge big hits of the year, and a completely original film, not a sequel, you know, not a franchise. All right, it's directed by the guy who did The Dark Knight, one of the biggest films of all time, but it's still an incredibly original piece of work. To see it doing so well is incredibly heartwarming, I think. I think it's fantastic. It has its naysayers, you know, the backlash has started, but I still think it's a fantastic thing that it's doing such good business. And look out for Leo DiCaprio's Wedding Ring.
A good bit of tippage there. It's off the top in the States, though, by the other guys. Will Ferrell's new movie.
Well, it can't be number one all the time. It can't be number one for the whole summer. It's done amazingly well, though.
Number 2, Night and Day.
Yes, anything but original, of course, but it just goes to show that if you've got Tom Cruise and Cameron Diaz in a movie and they've been on Top Gear the week before, it can get in number 2. And the question will be whether it holds up. Is the word of mouth going to be good on it? I suspect not, and my money is on it dropping like a stone next week.
But it took a lot of money.
It did.
Someone wrote an article in the New Statesman saying this film could single-handedly ruin Cameron Diaz and Tom Cruise's career. absolute nonsense. It's doing really well. It will do really well all around Europe. It's been a little bit disappointing in America, but it still shows that actually star power can open a film big, certainly here and around Europe, not quite as big in America.
But are we surprised just how big it opened?
Not for me, because I think, you know, the trailer's good, it's fun, people want, it's escapism. It's not great by any stretch, and it's, you know, it's completely a thing that's been put together as a star vehicle, but, you know, as star vehicles go, it's not awful.
Yeah, and I mean, it's critic proof. It doesn't matter how bad the reviews for a film like that are, if you've got that poster and those two stars, it's going to take money in the first week. The question is, what happens after that?
And at number one, there is absolutely no stopping Toy Story 3.
No, it's now one of the box office stories of the year, really. It's at number two in the last 12 months, only behind Avatar. It is the biggest animated film of all time. It's just unstoppable. And the incredible thing about it is it's still making more money per screen than any other film in the top 10. Only 2% down on last week. It's just unstoppable. And people are going back to see it again. You know, it's got the repeat viewing thing. Adults love it as much as kids. You know, there's one person wrote last week saying they didn't like it. I've only met two or three people who don't like this film.
Mm-hmm. Are we expecting Oscars for it?
I think it'll be, well, they've got the animated category, so it'll definitely be in that nomination. Whether it'll be in the Best Picture nomination, it's such a long time before the nominations come out, but it certainly deserves it. If there's a better film, let alone a better animated film this year, I'll be amazed.
Yeah, you see, that'll be the question, won't it? When there's actually the crossover from the animated section into, as it were, the mainstream live-action section. If it manages that and pulls that off, that will be a quantum leap forward for animated movies.
And thank you very much for all your text. We're getting a deluge of text messages on best and worst soundtracks. Hamish says, Local Hero by Mark Knopfler. Mm-hmm. We've got Martin in Burton and Trent. Best soundtrack, I was going to say The Mission by Morricone, but Mike Oldfield's The Killing Fields just edges it. And Rob in Lisburn in Ireland says, good day to you, yourself and Irene. That's not his nomination for best soundtrack, that's just a greeting. Best movie soundtrack, Once Upon a Time in America. This is because we have David Arnold, the Bond composer, coming into the studio. Different version of Tomorrow Never Dies there, originally by Sheryl Crow. That's because Dave Arnold's here. He's the man behind the music for the James Bond films and is hosting what I'd like to dub Live Aid for film composers. It's the second annual Concert for Care. It takes place at the Royal Albert Hall on October the 18th, and also with him is the show's producer, Tommy Pearson. I guess it's like sort of Midgeur and Bob Geldof in the room together. We're getting lots of text messages in on the best film soundtracks of all time in honour of your appearances. Check out Max Richter's Waltz with Bashir, stunning and evocative, and Michael Dana's The Ice Storm, my favourite film and soundtrack. That is from Graham Allen. Well, John Miller in Southampton says, refilm scores. Two of my favourites are Last of the Mohicans, the Michael Mann version, of course, and Gettysburg, both by Randy Edelman, who, like the soundtrack, is very underrated, in my opinion. Good afternoon, David Arnold.
Hi, how are you doing?
What do you make of those choices for the best soundtrack?
Well, that's the amazing thing, isn't it, about film music, that everyone's got an idea about what's the best and what's the worst. And, you know, you can put 1,000 people in a room, and they'll all come up with, you know, a separate soundtrack which they think this is the absolute best, and you'll find another 1,000 people who will be spitting in their faces going, don't be ridiculous, like Queen of Flash Gordon, for instance.
Now, what do you make of Flash Gordon's soundtrack?
It's amazing. And the funniest bit was, like, the professional bits were scored by someone else, you know, so the amateur bits got thrown to Queen. But I mean, it's like one of the most iconic bits of nonsense in the world, that film. It's absolutely brilliant.
You did use the word nonsense
though. Yeah. Well, I think if you've seen it, you know, there's absolutely no doubt that it is. It's utter kitsch and nonsense, but God, I love it.
Tommy Pearson, you've hosted many a film music show on Radio 3. Did anyone ever request Flash?
Well, no, but that's because it's Radio 3. I don't think we'd ever really be expecting it. But the two of us, by the way, are former members of the Queen fan club, so you're never going to hear anything negative about Queen from us.
Is that where you first met?
No.
Down the front row wearing clogs. Explain the concept behind the Concert for Care.
Care International is a charity that I've been ambassador for a few years, and I've been to Rwanda with them. And I mean, I know it's a cliche, you know, it's like, but they do the most extraordinary work. And the thing that really struck me about being there was that how much difference the smallest amount of money can make, you know, the smallest thing can make. You know, I was sitting with a woman who's, whose parents had been murdered in the genocide and had contracted HIV. A lot of the time people get HIV over there because they don't actually know what it is or how, you know, she caught it by looking after a mother who had it and caught it through, you know, blood contact. So it was for nothing dodgy. And she lost her parents and she was looking after her two little brothers from the age of 13. And she was sitting there in, you know, literally in a mud hut. And she told me that she'd borrowed £5 or something from the government to buy a sewing machine to try and make a life for herself. And I was thinking, how much did I spend on the cab to the airport to get to this place, you know? And it was absolutely obscene. And so you come back from those kinds of experiences and you think, like, well, how can we do something which is going to make a difference? Because believe me, every little thing does make a huge difference. And they make a big thing of making that money count. They have the lowest overhead of any charity. So, you know, I think it's around about about 10%. So if you give them a pound, 90 pence is going to go to the people that need it. And it does make a huge difference. So last year I did a concert at Brixton Academy, which was more sort of like a rock and roll thing. And it was like with Kaiser Chiefs, Gary Barlow, Damien Rice, Mark Ronson, and then like a friend of mine who are comedians, Rob Brydon, Daro Breen, and James Corden actually sang. And it was just a brilliant night. And I thought, like, if we could do something different this year for them in a slightly different environment. And I thought, well, film music is a bit of an easy, you know, it's an easier thing for me to do because I know, you know, pretty much all the film composers that there are. It's a little less tricky getting people's schedules sorted out because they know when they're finishing a movie and when, you know, they don't have to go on tour. And because we are behind the camera people, you know, generally we don't get asked to turn up and have our photographs taken or, you know, you need to do some TV or there's going to be an interview. So we're generally sort of rather anonymous. But the music, I think people know the music. And, you know, having done a couple of these concerts as well, you realise how popular they are with an audience. You know, they love hearing things from movies that they've been to see.
And Tommy, it's at the Royal Albert Hall.
Royal Albert Hall, Monday the 18th of October. Would you like me to tell you who's confirmed?
Give us the big names, because okay, there are some impressive ones.
I know you want it to be called the Live Aid of film music. There's that wonderful footage, isn't there, of Bob Geldof announcing everybody who's appearing at Live Aid, and literally none of them had actually confirmed at that moment.
These
people actually have confirmed.
please don't swear. Just
no, exactly. Okay, well, David, obviously, but we also have Craig Armstrong, who's going to be performing himself with music from Love Actually and the Oliver Stone movie World Trade Center. Harry Gregson-Williams and John Powell, who are both British film composers, but they live in Los Angeles. They're coming over especially. Harry's doing music from the first two Chronicles of Narnia movies. He's also done Shrek and Prince of Persia and lots of other movies. John Powell is doing music, we think, from How to Train Your Dragon, but also he also did the Bourne series and just did Night and Day, which you've been talking about. Anne Dudley, who won an Oscar for The Full Monty, she's coming. She's doing music from Bright Young Things, that was Stephen Fry's movie, and also Black Books, which is a Paul Verhoeven, Black Book, in fact, which is a Paul Verhoeven film, very different to the comedy series. Comedy. Yes, absolutely. Michael Nyman's coming to play the music from The Piano, which is his most famous creation. I mean, he's obviously also well known for working with Peter Greenaway and Michael Winterbottom more recently. Patrick Doyle, who does all of Kenneth Branagh's movies, his music is going to be from Much Ado About Nothing. And, as I say, he does all the Branagh movies. He also did Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, so he's in that series. Rachel Portman, who won an Oscar for Emma, she's doing music from Emma. She also did Cider House Rules, which I think we may also hear in the concert. She also did Chocolat and The Duchess fairly recently. Dario Marinelli, who won an Oscar for Atonement.
This is huge.
Oh, yes. We're having music from Atonement. Special
just
guest.
Keep it down to names now. Don't worry, all day.
No. I think it's worth mentioning. But Atonement, anyway. Yeah. Caroline Dale, the cellist who played on the original recording is coming especially as well to perform that. George Fenton, Blue Planet, music from The Blue Planet, which is a TV programme, of course, but he's best known for Gandhi and Cry Freedom and Groundhog Day and working with Ken Loach. We've got John Ottman coming over from Los Angeles. We're absolutely thrilled about that. John is a film editor as well as a composer, did The Usual Suspects, Superman Returns, Valkyrie,
And this is going to last hours.
And a couple of days so far. Just finally, Christopher Gunning, who's best known for writing the famous theme tune for the TV series Poirot, he won a BAFTA for his work on La Vie en Rose. And so he's coming in to conduct a special arrangement of Je ne regrette rien.
Seriously, how long is this concert?
It's going to be two hours.
This is overrunning. I guarantee you now.
But there's only one band, isn't there? So you don't have to get
there's only one band.
The Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
It's not as if you're going to have the audience singing along, you know, or you're going to say, OK, you hold the microphone out and they're going to do the middle eight from Stargate, you know. But so it's going to be fairly controlled and fairly easily timed. But no, I think it's going to be terrific. And, I mean, there are comedians at the moment. Jimmy Carr is going to be sort of doing some introductions and doing a bit of comedy. And there are a couple of others which we can't confirm yet, but also I'm trying to find a few people who are going to come and sing some songs from movies. And the first one we got confirmed is Paloma Faith is going to sing. We haven't decided what it's going to be yet, but Paloma's going to be singing. And I'm waiting for a couple of other friends just
She was in the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
Yeah, I know, and she was terrific in that as well. I met her years and years and years ago at a party, and she gave me her card. This is about 5 years ago, and she gave me a card, and the card was just a picture of her with a pair of braces on and a slightly odd red haircut. And we just absolutely hit it off immediately. We just talked absolute rubbish for about 4 hours straight, and then I never saw her for 5 years, and then she turned up and she was famous.
Is she going to sing a Bond song?
Well, we don't know. I mean, I think there might be, you know, there's a couple of other people that I'm just waiting to hear from to see, you know, how we cast those, but she would be fabulous for one of those, I think.
So each of these composers comes out... And do they conduct
some of them? Some of them conduct. Those that don't conduct might play, or certainly they'll be talking about it. But the fact is that we're all going to be there in a big gang, and that never, ever, ever happens.
And I was thinking, I mean, has there ever been anything like this before with that many composers?
No, really. I don't think so. I mean, I think people who like film music get very excited about it. But generally, as I said before, you could sit on a bus with every film composer that ever existed in the world. You know, you could be on a bus next to John Barry, John Williams, Jerry Goldsmith, Bernard Herrmann, and you'd never know who they were, because, you know, we're not in front of the camera.
Do Bernard Herrmann, the one trick pony.
Oh yeah,
I was joking. I love Bernard Herrmann. Do you travel around in a big bus with all these composers? And it feels like, because you know them all, then, so you almost like.
Well, the funny thing is, I was with Danny Elfman today, because he's recording up at the studio where I'm writing at the moment. And generally, we bump into each other at recording studios or the occasional like awards thing. And you can always tell when the composer's there. A, because there's free beer, and secondly, they're the ones with, you know, studio tans and, you know, rubbing their eyes and realising that there is a human existence outside of the room where we work most of the time.
We're getting so many text messages in on people's favourite movie soundtracks. People are really passionate about movie soundtracks. Damien in Farringdon says, best movie soundtrack ever has to be Saturday Night Fever. The worst one, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 1. Is that the one Vanilla Ice is in? I think it could be a diss at the ice. Lee from The Wirral says, anything by John Barry, Dances with Wolves, Bond to Persuaders. Kubrick again says, Damien of Stepney, worst soundtrack is to The Invasion of the Killer Tomatoes or anything by Russ Meyer. While Davin Rill says, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is a wonderful soundtrack, hauntingly beautiful. How do you feel about the jukebox soundtrack?
Well, I'm just sitting here thinking, like, thank God I've got neither no one's favourite or no one's worst one. You know, sometimes you're a little bit of a knife edge thinking, someone's going to say, I hate that thing he did for that. Jukebox soundtrack. Well, I think if it's for the right sort of thing, for the right sort of movie, you'd think, well, of course it's absolutely perfect. I mean, Quentin Tarantino, you know, taking it one step along from Martin Scorsese, you know, if it's the right sort of song in the right sort of movie, then it does what a score can't do. It's a bit like a joke. You know, it's like you get the joke immediately. I know when I did Zoolander, you know, there are a couple of song placements in that, He Ain't Heavy, He's My Brother, which were just hilarious. But it's hilarious, and then it does the job, and then you're kind of on to the next thing. I mean, I think what score does is that it kind of goes beyond the initial sort of impact of a song that you already know, and it allows you some access to something emotional in the film that you might not otherwise have. So it's a very different job. But I mean, I like it. It's interesting that most of these things are people's soundtracks. They're talking about, you know, a lot of them are songs. And I think that's the way people perceive film soundtracks now. It's like the overall musical experience.
Greenwood one always pops up with There Will Be Blood.
Yep,
so
boys.
Many people.
Yeah.
The reason, by the way, it couldn't be Oscar nominated is because a large proportion of it wasn't written for the film, and it has to be an origination.
Sure, but don't you think that's... But there's still a huge amount of stuff that he did originate, that he did compose. Mm-hmm.
But it has to be a certain amount.
Yeah.
One thing that interests me is when you're sort of programming something like that, there might be music that works perfectly in the context of the film. From your point of view, you know, as an insider, you think, that's a brilliant piece of scoring, that's fantastic. Now, for instance, I like the assassination of Jesse James, the Nick Cave one. Yeah, I think that's a fantastic soundtrack. But if I try and listen to it separate from the film, it doesn't sort of stand up for me as music. Yeah. I can't imagine going to a concert where people were playing it, or even extracts from it. But when I watch the film, it's for me, it's like note perfect, and it carries that film through. I love that film anyway. But are there certain choices where you thought, I really love that score, but actually it's not going to work at the Albert Hall?
Always. Well,
yeah, I mean, I think the other thing about it is that the reason why film music exists is because it's written for a film. You know, I mean, the fact that it works well away from it is sometimes just good luck and good fortune. You know, I mean, but you certainly don't go into a movie thinking, like, what can I get out of this beyond the job that I'm being asked to do? And the job that you're being asked to do is to dramatise the movie with music. And that's really all it needs to do, you know. I mean, if it works away from that, then lucky us, you know. And there's been plenty, you know, there's plenty of performable, amazing stuff, you know, all John Williams stuff, John Barry, Jerry Goldsmith, Bernard Herrmann, you know, so much of it is you know, just great tunes. And you realise that when you go to these film music concerts, or, you know, any of the concerts where they'll have a film music thread, is that, you know, as soon as you hear the opening of these movies, you know, they kind of, it's a bit like a hit record, you know. I mean, that's what John Barry was so amazing at. Like, the first 5 seconds, you're there immediately. It's sold. The idea is sold. It's fabulous.
David Arnold in the studio with Tommy Pearson, because they are talking about their Concert for Care, which takes place at the Royal Albert Hall on October the 18th, featuring some of the most famous film composers in the world. And we are getting so many emails in about film soundtracks. Ollie in London, disgusted at the choice of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles as worst soundtrack. The score for that movie is by John Dupre. Is he from Modern Romance?
Yes.
Modern Romance.
Yes,
he was the one, it was the soundtrack that got me into the power of film music. I wish it was released in CD. It's fantastic. Either of you heard it, Tommy or David?
No, he did Fish Called Wanda, didn't he?
Yeah.
He does a lot with the Monty Python lot.
Yeah.
Ollie says, best score, End of the Affair, Michael Nyman, worst any cheesy standard rom-com score. And we've got an email from Keith Bailey, who wants to say hello to David Arnold. I'm a soundtrack composer for TV, although I haven't graduated for film. I'm very much Lenny Lawrence to David's Jose Mourinho. He says, huge fan of old... Oh, yeah, he does say he has played guitar in some recent movies, including The Forbidden Kingdom and Creek. A huge fan of old David's work, enjoying the Sherlock score too. In fact, let's hear a bit of that. I think we've got that to hand.
Have we?
And he'd like to suggest the following scores as his favourites. It's Paris, Texas and Ry Cooder. There's the Sherlock score coming in underneath. Keith nominates Paris, Texas by Ry Cooder and The Player, Thomas Newman's 1992. Actually, I'll be quiet so we can hear a bit of Sherlock. Boyd Hilton, how important is a good TV theme?
Well, I think that I wanted us to play that theme tune to Sherlock, because I think that is the best. I'm not just saying this because David's here and I know him, but that is the best theme tune to a TV show for many years. I think it's beautiful. It's kind of it's a great melody, but it also kind of sums up the whole tone of the show of Sherlock, because it's slightly old school, but it's got a kind of modern think vibe going on. It's so perfectly judged. And I think when it's good, when a theme tune is good for a show like that, then it's magical. And that just works so perfectly.
It's one of those, it's a difficult thing. I mean, I should just say that, I mean, Sherlock was done with Michael Price, who's an amazing composer as well. We did it between the pair of us. But it's interesting talking about theme tunes, because for me, I haven't really done that much TV. I mean, the other one was Little Britain, which is actually how I met Boyd through David Walliams. And, you know, that was a theme tune that I wanted it to... I mean, I was a big fan of, like, old-school theme tunes, you know, ones that were recognisable. Some of them were slightly odd, you know, even if it was Fawlty Towers or Dad's Army, or some others do have them, you know. But you kind of knew what the show was as soon as you heard it. And for me, like, the thing with Little Britain was I felt like I wanted to write, like, a national anthem for those people, you know, something which... was like reaching beyond its means, but still try to get there. And initially, I was going to record it with a really, really bad orchestra, you know, so it just sounded rubbish. But then I thought it would be better to write it for us, like a big symphonic kind of thing, so almost like Last Night of the Proms, but then record it with a really small amount of people, so it sounded like it was just a bit too difficult. And that was the music for a little bit. But with Sherlock, it's one of those things that you struggle to try and describe what it is that you're trying to do, and the best way to do it is just actually write the music and play it for someone. And it's a very complicated character, and the show is a very specific kind of time and place, and it was trying to find something which felt sort of classic, contemporary, but also, you know, was this kind of curiosity. You know, the whole thing is this, there's a huge unknown about Sherlock, about him at his core, about who he is and where he's come from, which you never ever find out, but he's kind of like endlessly fascinating. And you know, based the bulk of the score that we did with Michael was, you know, based in and around that theme and the chords therein.
We seem to be talking about Sherlock on the show almost every day. It's just been the most monumental summer hit. Why do you think it's so popular?
Because it's good, and it's very, very simple. I know that Mark Gatiss came to show me the pilot episode last February 2009, because they were undecided about a couple of things, and we were just talking about music for it, and there was no music on it at the time. And I remember I just said to Mark, I said, this is probably the best bit of TV I've seen in 5 years. It just seemed to have everything right. I mean, the script was kind of electrifying and witty and fast, and Benedict is probably my favourite British actor ever. I mean, I just think he's absolutely phenomenal. And in everything that he's done. And I met him when we did Amazing Grace, and he was playing William Pitt the Younger from a Michael Apted movie about the end of the slave trade. And he was astonishing in that. It was just an odd thing. It's like, you know, I spoke to him the other week. I went down to see him at the National Theatre, and I said, like, I think we just make a deal that I will just score everything that you're in and nothing else, because he's like a sort of talisman. He's absolutely fabulous.
He seems to be a real rising star.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just think he's a brilliant actor, and I think to make a Sherlock Holmes memorable now, after all the iconic ones that we've had, and even after Robert Downey Jr.'s, you know, like, brilliant reading of it, to make something else completely different, you know, for someone so young and effectively fearless in that role, because he could have really fallen down. But I think Martin is absolutely fabulous in it. I think Martin Freeman is brilliant as the human side. I mean, his voice is the voice through which we can understand his place in that, and therefore Sherlock can be as kind of cruel and as distant as he likes from time to time, but Martin kind of always brings us back home again. So, brilliant double act.
Tommy Pearson, how accepted, and we were saying that you work a lot of the time for Radio 3 doing film music shows, how accepted is film music and the type of music that David Arnold makes? How is it accepted by the classical world?
Well, I mean, it's becoming more and more accepted. I mean, there's no doubt, for example, that the influence on film music on the classical world, certainly from the younger generation of composers, is massive these days. I mean, I hear it all the time. You see scores and you hear scores from young composers who are in the conservatoires, and they, these days, as is often the way, they've got pound signs in their eyes, and they've worked out that the only possible way they could make money and also write music is perhaps to write music for television and film, which is why conservatoires all over the world are full of people who just want to be film composers now. I think that's a big mistake. I think it's good to be a composer first and then perhaps end up in TV and film, because I think the important thing is you have the skills in the first place. But it's certainly true that the influence is starting to get broader. I mean, the other way around, it hasn't really ever happened all that much with the, you know, what's been happening in the classical world actually going into film music, because a lot of film music is based on the old 19th century Strauss and Mahler.
Well, Martin's, it happened this year with Shutter Island, where they went for a contemporary classical soundtrack.
Yeah, well, Martin Scorsese often does that, because these patchwork scores again that he does. I mean, he's done that a few times now. When he's not using songs, he's also using bits of this, bits of that. He loves doing all that. But it's about, I mean, David was talking about this before, it's about what happens that's most effective for the film, really, in the end. That's all that matters, is whether it works well with the scene in question.
This is 5 Live.
It's the Friday Film Review with Boyd and Floyd, and in the studio, Bond composer David Arnold and Tommy Pearson, who is putting together a concert with them at the Royal Albert Hall
on October the 18th, featuring some of the greats of film music. And Tommy, you're wanting to pick up on a point you're making.
I just wanted to, because Nigel was talking about, and you were asking me about the influence and what the classical world thinks of film music. I should say that orchestras all over the world are falling over themselves to perform film music these days.
The Star Wars tour is huge.
Tour was absolutely huge. Well, it was always going to be, wasn't it? Let's be honest, because people are going not just for the music, they're going for the experience, and it was an extraordinary experience. But no, everywhere you go, everyone wants to put on film music. It fills halls. You know, people love to come and hear their favourite themes wherever they happen to be and whoever they happen to play them. So that's certainly what we're hoping, of course, at the Royal Albert Hall. It's a big hall to fill, so we're hoping lots of people are going to come. By the way, I haven't mentioned yet the website, which is where everybody can find all the information that you need to get the tickets and everything for this concert on the 18th of October. It's www.concertforcare.com. Very easy to remember.
Do people ever shout out requests at this type of event?
Concerts? Well, only if they don't quite know how it works. I did go and see John Williams at the Hollywood Bowl once, and for the entire concert, everybody was shouting out, "Do Star Wars," as if there was any question he was not going to do it. And then, of course, the third encore or something comes on, bang, it's the opening of Star Wars. And I looked behind me, I was quite near the front, I looked behind me, and of course everybody's got the lightsabers out and they're dressed up and they're just having a fun time.
Are you expecting any fancy on October the 18th?
Oh gosh, well,
everyone, yes, sort of. Every male should dress as James Bond, I think.
Well, like you don't anyway.
Well, the orchestra usually ends up looking like James Bond anyway, the way they dress.
We are getting so many emails today. Michael in London was talking about how we're talking about jukebox soundtracks versus scored soundtracks. He's got a criteria. If I hear a song that's used in a jukebox soundtrack and think about the film, it has worked. This works for Pulp Fiction songs. If I hear the song and want to watch the film again, it's worked fantastically. If I hear any Queen song from a film, I want to watch that film. So Flash Gordon works, but Highlander even more. Yes. And dear group Captain Lionel Mandrake, President Merkin Muffley and Doctor Strangelove, maybe not the worst, but the most irritating soundtrack of recent years, Kimya Dawson's soundtrack for Juno, which is trying its absolute best to ruin an otherwise great film. It goes out of its way to be whimsical and quirky, yet its childish vocals and lyrics combined with Dawson's limited instrumental ability is completely at odds with Juno's proclaimed love of heavy metal and punk rock music, distracting, jarring, and far too overwhelmingly for such a great understated movie. That's from Rachel in Glasgow.
Yeah, that's what everyone said coming out of that film, didn't they?
But dude, Arnold, there are people,
those whimsical vocals. Yeah.
People,
damn them.
It is a complaint that I do hear people saying, particularly with TV, the overscoring of movies and TV shows.
Yeah, I think part of that is because of the way that people make movies nowadays. I mean, you know, it seems odd that I'm going like in the olden days, but in the olden days when I started, which is now about 15 or 16 years ago, you know, you cut a movie, you cut film, you know, it was like on a big Steenbeck. It was like you had to thread the thing up, you had to thread up the sound. It took quite an effort to make a change, and you had to be pretty sure about what it is that you were going to do. And a bit like the way that CD, I think, have changed the way that people listen to music now, because, you know, if you put a record on and you didn't like it, you couldn't fast forward to it, you couldn't sit in your chair and zip it onto the next bit, and you couldn't reprogram the running order, so, you know, leaving out the ones that you didn't like. You had to get up off your chair and lift the needle up and put it onto the next track. With CDs, you know, you can just fast forward, or you can skip, you can reprogram, and the way movies are made nowadays, they all go into a digital machine, and the cuts can be done just a keystroke on a computer. So you can try a million different things, you know, very, very easy and very, very quickly. And a lot of the time now, because obviously there always has been, but there's so much money at stake, when you show scenes to like studio executives, I think the preponderance is to try and impress everyone as much as you can. A lot of the time, that's, you know, you're not showing them the whole movie. You might be showing them a 3-minute sequence. And usually they'll put music in that to sell the sequence to the studio and to make sure that they can carry on making the movie they may want to make it. And then everyone gets used to music being there all the time. And then by the time you get to the end of the show and, you know, you put all these things together, you find you've got music going from start to finish. I think it needs a particularly sort of strong director and you know, confidence in the work that they're doing in order to let it breathe. I mean, I'm a big fan of having a lot of space in movies, but I mean, I'm doing the Chronicles of Narnia at the moment, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and there's a lot of music in that film, and, you know, we're looking for spaces for it not to be, but every time someone moves a face or a camera moves, you know, it kind of suggests something which might might need music just to let an audience know what's going on. I mean, those are kind of big Hollywood movies. It tends not to happen in European, Japanese films. You know, it's mainly in the big studio movies that you get that sort of approach.
Can you imagine that Psycho nearly didn't have any music at all? And it wasn't until Herman went away and said, leave it to me, and came back with the music that we all now know and love. Most of us love.
Love it. I just said it was similar to North by North West. That was all.
He's a genius. Very much upset. It's some of the most famous bit of music that's ever been committed to film.
Which neatly leads us on to another aspect of your charity event, because you are doing a special screening of Cycle.
We are. The day before the Concert for Care on the Sunday at the Empire Leicester Square, one of the biggest, best screens in the country. We're showing Psycho to, I would imagine, an audience that a lot of them haven't seen Psycho on the big screen, let alone one as big as that. And also, it's a digital version, so it's banging out of those speakers as well. All that music, full-blooded. It's at 9:30 in the morning, because that's when we can squeeze in a screening before they have to show Toy Story 3 or whatever it is they're going to be showing at that point. But it's going to be a fantastic opportunity, and it's £20 per ticket. And, of course, nearly all of that goes to care.
And what's David's role that night, then?
I'll be there with a knife.
Which cues us nicely for the most famous... Is this the most famous moment in film score music ever?
It made the movie. The music makes the movie. When you see Marion driving along near the beginning, when we wouldn't know unless you hear the soundtrack. You don't know what she's doing. You don't know whether she's escaping, whether she's scared of the police or not, or whether she's got any money on her. You don't know any of that. But Herman gives all of that to you in the music.
There's a very good Hitchcock documentary which I saw years ago where they showed you that scene, the shower scene, without Bernard Herrmann's music, and without it, it's kind of weirdly flat, and it's a kind of odd thing to see without the music. The music totally makes
it. It's difficult analysing that one because it's so iconic, you know, and it's so embedded in everyone's subconscious. It's difficult to take it away, I think. But I mean, certainly, if you came up to my studio and I showed you scenes from a movie that have no music on, I mean, it does make an extraordinary difference. I'm not saying that because I do it, but I mean, obviously, the music is there for a reason, and that's to elevate and to make it almost three dimensional.
Have you ever been given a film to do and you've agreed to do the soundtrack, and then you get the finished film and you say, and you think, this is just awful,
No, I've had a couple of tricky ones, but I think we pulled it off in the end.
Which was the film that made you want to go into doing soundtracks?
I saw about three films over a summer when I was about 7 or 8 years old, and it was You Only Live Twice, John Barry one, it was Jungle Book, and it was Oliver, all of which were like huge, and Wizard of Oz, huge, visually brilliant, tons of great songs in it, and the scores are all hugely idiosyncratic and quite amazing. So I think it was that, you know, I had a summer where it was kind of embedded, and that was the end of it.
Can sing You Only Live Twice as well, can't you?
I've been known to sing You Only Live Twice.
Have you seen Splain Boyd?
I've watched David sing You Only Live Twice at David Williams' Stag Do, which had a James Bond Stars in Their Eyes. I think it was the highlight of the whole event, and David Arnold has got a beautiful singing voice. A difficult song to sing, I think.
I thought it was very significant you said you watched him sing.
The funniest thing is Alan Carr was there as well. Anyway, I was singing this song, and I was trying to do it as best as I could because it's David's wedding, you know. It's his stag do. It was very sober and very proper. And it wasn't misbehaved at all. And we were there, and we were singing You Only Live Twice, and Alan Carr... I mean, because obviously I don't look like the sort of person who might be able to sing anything. But Alan Carr, I just heard him lean over and he said to someone, "Susan Boyle."
Hey, but that's a compliment.
It would be remiss of me if I didn't ask the question when we got you here. The front of Entertainment Weekly this week in the States, goodbye, Mr. Bond. The LA Times has run a big article this week saying what on earth is going on with the James Bond franchise. What do you know?
Well, it's quite simple. I mean, MGM are in a bit of trouble financially, and they are working that out Well, they have been working it out for quite a long time, but they're not really in a position at the moment that we can go into production with the company being the way that it is. So basically, all that's happened is we've just put the brakes on everything until the MGM situation has settled down. But I know that this week, I think they're talking to a couple of people who might be then running the company. It's all to do with the financing and acquisitions and debts and, you know, I don't know, the sort of complicated thing that makes your head spin. And you know, there's a lot of money involved in studios, and MGM are one of the old great ones, you know, that have kind of fallen on slightly harder times of recent years. So we're really just waiting for that situation to go. But I mean, everyone's there, you know, chomping at the bit, waiting to be given the green light.
But Daniel Craig's starting to sign up for other films. He's doing the Girl with the Tattoo, and so yes, it's going to cause all sorts of problems.
Yeah, I really don't think it'll be a problem. I really, seriously don't think it'll be a problem. I think it's just a matter of time waiting for that situation to arise. I mean, all that happened is that it won't be next year. You know, it might be the year after or something like that. But it's just a matter of waiting for that. I think there's a huge amount of there always is speculative journalism about Bond, whether it's, you know, the state of the movie, who's going to be playing him. I mean, you know, the kind of hoopla that there was when Daniel was announced initially was, you know, some of it was disgraceful. Some of it was just disbelieving, you know. And it's just because it's such a big, iconic thing, everyone wants to talk about it, you know. And I think it's an interesting question to ask what's going to happen, but until the MGM situation gets resolved, I mean, no one really knows. But it's just a matter of when rather than never.
And there was talk about who's going to direct it. Sam Mendes has worked on it with Peter Morgan.
Yeah, Sam Mendes is, I think, still attached. Yeah, and at the moment, Sam and Daniel and Barbara Broccoli and Michael G. Wilson, the producers, you know, everyone's just holding fire. So at the moment, it's that situation. We're just waiting.
How frustrating is it?
It's probably more frustrating for the crew and everyone, you know, like writing the thing. I mean, for me, it feels like there's a little bit of a breather, which I'm in a way sort of quite looking forward to, because there's a bunch of other things that are, you know, sometimes you get asked to do things that you can't do because you're doing something else. And what it's done is it's freed up next year for me now. So there's a whole bunch of other things I can do. And it's all, I mean, Bond is so in your life all the time when you're involved in it, you know. And it's very rare that you'll get through a moment without, if someone's talking about you professionally, certainly, that's not what is, you know. Most of the time it's like the name's Arnold, David Arnold, you know, if it's a magazine article, you know, and it's there.
A joke that is never funny in any circumstance.
Yeah, but it throws a very long shadow over everything, you know. It's just there all the time, which I'm immensely proud of and pleased to be associated with. But it's nice to get out and do other things as well. So I mean, it'll be probably a good 8 or 9 other movies now between Quantum of Solace and the next Bond for me. So you know, it's a good way to think about how you're going to do the next one, you know, trying to push it on forward, trying to do something a bit different.
It was an unexpected choice of theme singer last time with Jack White and Alicia Keys.
It was a little, yeah, but I mean Jack's like a force of nature, you know. He's like self-contained whirlwind of ideas, and like in that, a very elemental musician. And Alicia Keys is just like sort of delightful and lovely and happy to be there, and a brilliant singer and a brilliant keyboard player. But I think that's the point of these things sometimes is not to do the obvious, you know, because, you know, there was a point, you know, we keep saying about it, like, I mean, Live and Let Die was a song that wasn't, you know, that kind of Bond song didn't exist until that one happened, you know. And and to a certain extent, I guess The Spy Who Loved Me, you know, which was like a big kind of ballad, was not, you know, the kind of movie song stylistically that had been a Bond song before. So, you know, I mean, the idea of what makes a Bond song and what doesn't, I think, changes like so many things do. But
any on your wish list? You've mentioned Paloma Faith. She could be.
Yeah, well, there's, I mean, the thing is, there's always great stuff. You know, we're sort of thinking that, you know, Amy Winehouse would have been great as well, you know, and certainly, you know, around the Quantum of Solace time when we were talking about her, but she's a bit too ill to do it. And but, you know, I just think it's like you kind of cast the song when you know what the movie's about and you know the kind of thing that you're after, because who might be brilliant for one film might not be brilliant for another.
Susan Boyle?
Yeah, you know what? I'm not knocking anyone. It's like
it's final Bond question.
Susan Boyle or me?
Yeah,
you, no, Howard, you can Susan take Boyle.
Final Bond question. If you could predict when we are going to have the next Bond film in the cinema.
If I could predict it, which it's ridiculous. It's you know, if MGM, if they get at the end of this week, they say, OK, we're on, you know, it might be 2012. You know, but yeah, so you know, it's utterly unpredictable at present. Otherwise, someone would say, this is when we're going to be doing it.
That is the sound of James Bond fan club blogs being updated at this very
well,
second.
Well, they're pretty on it, those guys. You know, I mean, like, everything is there, which is why it's, basically the situation hasn't changed. I don't know how many times I'm going to say it. It's like, it hasn't really changed. We have to wait for MGM to sort out. And but everyone's, you know, still on board and raring to go. And there's still as much energy and affection and love for it.
That's so. David Arnold, Bond composer. The concert for Care takes place at the Royal Albert Hall on October the 18th. Thank you very much to Tommy Pearson, who's helping to produce the night. One last time, where people can get tickets for that and the cycle screening the night before.
All you have to do is go to the website, www.concertforcare.com. The cycle screening is at 9:30 on Sunday the 17th of October, and the concert is the following day on the 18th of October at the Royal Albert Hall at 7:30. Please come for a fantastic cause and the best ever lineup of film composers you'll ever find.
We're going to have to crash through the film reviews because David Arnold was giving away far too much about James Bond to let him go. First film exactly. Today, The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yes, this is it's the kind of second attempt by Disney and the producers to come up with a kind of new big summer blockbuster. They did Prince of Persia earlier this year. And I don't think that did as well as they hoped it would. This is The Sorcerer's Apprentice. It's the same team that did National Treasure, the two National Treasure movies, the director John Turteltaub, and Nick Cage is in it, who was also in those films. Basically, the beginning of... It's also kind of inspired by the great sequence in Fantasia, with Mickey Mouse got all the mops to dance around and mop up and clean for him, which is a classic bit of animated film. And there is a reference to that in the middle of this film. So they've come up, basically, with a high-concept way of having kind of magic and Merlin and all this stuff, but in the modern day. And Nick Cage is basically a modern-day sorcerer, and Jay Baruchel, who's a kind of indie, you've seen him in kind of indie films, he's a kind of slightly geeky figure, and he's his young apprentice. And in this clip we'll hear how Nick Cage teaches him the ins and outs of magic.
I'm going to give you the basics, strictly sorcery 101. Put on the ring. Nothing's going to happen.
Yeah?
Kidding. You've heard how people use only 10% of their brains. Sorcerers can manipulate matter because they're born with the capability to use the entire power of their brains.
So wait, is sorcery science or magic?
Yes and yes. For now, all you need is a basic combat spell, making fire. What causes molecules to heat up?
They vibrate.
Everything we see is in a constant state of vibration, thus the illusion of solidity. But how do we take that which appears solid and have it burst into flames? We will the vibrations to go faster. Step one, clear your mind. Step two, see the molecules. Step three, make them shake. Oh. Got it?
No, I definitely don't got it.
Trust the ring, Dave.
Trust the ring. Nicolas Cage, the man who switched on the Christmas lights in Bath last year. Jeremy Dillon in Sydney, Australia, has sent a slightly mean-spirited email. Dear Peter, Paul and Mary, with The Sorcerer's Apprentice on the review list this week, will there be an answer to the question on everyone's lips? What is Nicolas Cage's hairpiece like?
Well, actually, he's got a very long, shaggy hairpiece in this film, which is slightly distracting, I have to say. And in fact, students of Nick Cage hair, I don't think we've seen him with this kind of haircut, actually, I have to say, unless I'm very much mistaken. But it is slightly odd. But he does play this guy who's been locked up in a jar, basically, in an ancient jar for hundreds, thousands of years. And then he bursts out when the Jay Baruchel character kind of somehow accidentally wakes him up. I mean, the whole thing, we have to say, is incredibly contrived. The first 10 minutes of this film, as far as I can remember, I only saw it this week, is basically explaining their way of having these characters making magic in modern-day New York. And it's a very long, convoluted way of tracing it back to Merlin, basically. But, you know, having said that, there were elements of this film I quite liked. I really liked it. It's set in Manhattan, and it has some very nice ways of incorporating that into the storyline. So they use that big bull statue thing in downtown New York in the Financial District, for example, in quite a creative way in the climax. All kinds of elements of the elements of the architecture they use. It's quite creative in that way. And there are set pieces in it which are quite... So there's a Chinatown set piece where the dragon in the big... you know, Chinese New Year celebrations turns into a proper dragon and starts attacking them. And I think that actually families and kids will be mildly entertained. I think it's better than a lot of the films that are aimed at families, family audiences. And I think and it's kind of enjoyable to see Nick Cage going over the top, not as over the top as he was in Bad Lieutenant, which is obviously his over the top comedic performance of the year, but it is enjoyable watching him do it. And it's got Alfred Molina as the villain, who I think is the best thing in it, and it's highly enjoyable watching Alfred Molina chewing the scenery and being incredibly over the top and doing
it. And it's called The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Tributes to Fantasia?
Yeah, there is a kind of recreation of that scene in the middle of the film. There's all kinds of ways they find to try and get that, squeeze that scene in. But actually, it's very enjoyable, and it uses the same music, and it's kind of good fun.
Nigel?
Yeah, it has its moments. I mean, the thing about this, you know, Jerry Bruckheimer, is he throws stuff at the screen, and when it sticks, it sticks, and when it doesn't, it's kind of moving fast enough for you not to care too much. I thought there was just a little bit too much going on in this. I loved Alfred Molina as the arch nemesis. I thought Nick Cage was toning it down a bit, and that worked for me. Very weird performance by Jay Baruchel, who's very likeable, but sounds just like Christian Slater. It's uncanny how much his voice and intonation sounds exactly like Christian Slater.
What else would we know him from?
Knocked Up. He was in Knocked Up. I mean, he's been around. He's one of those guys who always plays like the third or fourth guy along, you know, the geeky little guy. So it's interesting to see him in what is effectively a lead role here. There's a slightly contrived romance. He's trying to get off with this girl and he's impressing her with his knowledge of physics. There's some nice stuff also about the idea of, is this physics or magic? Well, it's a little bit of both. So there's a combination of the two things. And I did quite like the scene where they recreated the famous Sorcerer's Apprentice scene, you know, where they actually did the mops and the buckets and the water and all that. I mean, they've certainly thrown money at it. And I agree with Boyd. It's kind of one of those sort of middling three-star family movies that you wouldn't be disappointed by. But on the other hand, it's probably not going to be as big as something like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Well, Parade magazine in the US listed it last month as the biggest flop of the year. It's cost $150 million and it only has taken under $60 million.
Yeah,
I mean, Nine Days proven us wrong, though. Will it be a bigger hit in the UK?
I think it will be a bigger hit in the UK. I think the timing of the release was a bit weird in America, and it is hugely expensive. And the thing is, it's difficult to get people to go and see films that aren't a ready-made franchise or a sequel or something like that. And I think, you know, youngsters won't even know about Sorcerer's Apprentice or Fantasia and any of that, so it's meaningless to them. And I'm not sure how much parents think, oh, I must go and see a film with a scene in it that's based on a scene in Fantasia. So it didn't have anything about it that was an immediate port. And I don't think Nick Cage nor Jay Baruchel, who's very good, he was in She's Out of My League, which is one of the year's better romantic comedies. He's very good in it, and I do think he's very likable, but I don't think it's got anything intrinsic that's going to draw people to it, and it's not quite good enough to make it like a must-see film.
I was going to try and do Black Dynamite before the news, but I think it deserves longer than a squeezed couple of minutes, so I'm going to read out a couple of the emails that are coming in on the best and worst soundtracks. Mark Ferris saying, hello Boyd and Floyd, the soundtrack from the original Predator film by Alan Silvestri is great, makes the film twice as exciting. While Daniel in Edinburgh says, two of his favourite film soundtracks of recent years would have to be Run, Lola, Run, which features some high-energy tracks that perfectly complement the pace of the film, composed by the director Tom Twicker, and Michael Andrews' score to Donnie Darko, which was suitably ethereal and mysterious, although the Star Wars and Indiana Jones scores are hard to beat. Five films to get through in 25 minutes, starting with Black Dynamite. It was out in the States last year. Simon in Exeter managed to see it. Saw this while on holiday a couple of weeks back. Awful dialogue, stiffly performed. Oh, that's the wrong film. Simon Exeter.
I bet I know what that film
this.
Was.
Simon Exeter has managed to send in two different emails. Black Dynamite, without a doubt, the best spoof since Airplane. A loving homage to blaxploitation movies like Shaft, Superfly and Coffee, and shoves it to the man. The end, revelation and fight. Does Nigel Floyd agree?
Yeah, it's true. There was a movie a couple of years ago called I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, which had the same sort of approach as this. This is more loving, I think, more respectful in a way of the old blaxploitation movies. Shaft, of course, was the film that started it all. What I loved about it was that it had such an attention to period detail. It had a nice tongue-in-cheek tone. For example, there's a pimp who's called Mo Bitches, which I think is a good gag. And it had all the kind of jive-talking black guys who are incredibly cool. The lead guy, Michael J. White, who kind of wrote the screenplay in tandem with the director, Scott Sanders, has obviously created this whole persona for himself. He's got the sideburns, he's got the fantastic Afro haircut, he's got the really deep, chocolatey voice, and he does everything. He's got the Magnum, the 44 Magnum, he's got the nunchucks, so there's a little bit of kung fu fighting in there. There's nothing that's not there. It also has the best cliche plot ever, because in this plot it is alleged that, of course, the crooked, honky white folks, the cops and the politicians, are the ones who are trying to get the new master drug into orphanages. And if we listen to this, he's trying to elicit the help here of some members of a black political organization, very much like the Black Panthers.
This is private. How'd you get in here?
I walked in.
So you one of them sneaky brothers, huh? Or maybe you an undercover pig. Or maybe you just a federal hitman.
If I was, you cats would already be dead. Now let me speak to the man in charge.
Sarcastically, I'm in charge. I don't.
If you were in charge, the people might as well surrender to Whitey right now. Because your survival skills ain't worth a damn.
Black Dynamite! Yeah, it's been a long time, my brother.
What it is, Saheed?
You know this, Uncle Tom.
Listen, sucker. I'm blacker than the Ace of Spades and more militant than you and your whole damn army put together. And while you out there chanting at rallies and browbeating politicians, I'm taking out any money front sucker on a Hummel that gets in my way.
See, I just loved all that dialogue. Also, the music. I didn't mention the music. The music is absolutely perfect pastiche of those kinds of songs that you heard in all those things, which were never that great, but just had a sort of generic, sort of funky black sound to them. There were a couple of movies like Badge 373 that had really, really good soundtracks, but most of them were sort of, like the plots, very formulaic, and he nails that completely.
David Arnold did the remake of Shaft. We could have asked him about the soundtrack.
We could have.
How does it compare to something like the Tarantino Grindhouse, which was sort of paid homage to that kind of era of movie?
It's very different. I think Tarantino would enjoy this movie because it has all the references in it, and he would get more than we get, of course, because he sat there relentlessly watching these films while he was the video clerk in Los Angeles doing nothing but watching videos. He would know all the references, all the little in-jokes. We probably missed, you know, several dozen of them just going by, nice little nods and things like that. But there's enough there for a mainstream audience to get it as well.
Yeah, I think it does have, the thing that Grindhouse did, that this film does, is you know, like an attention to detail, and that it tried to replicate the look of those films. And this does do a brilliant job technically of looking like a film that's made in 1973. You know, in terms of the film stock and the look of the wallpaper and all of that, production design is all great. I actually think my only problem with it is that I think almost so much attention has been paid to that stuff that it's not quite funny enough. And I think if you do compare it to Airplane, Airplane had, as we talked last week about, you know, it being, in my opinion, the funniest comedy of the last 30
Happy
years.
Happy 30th birthday.
Happy 30th birthday, Airplane. Gags every minute, three or four gags every minute. This doesn't have three or four gags every minute. You're lucky if you get a gag every 3 or 4 minutes, to be honest, even though I think it's funny that the situations are funny and the characters are funny, but actually the dialogue and the jokes, to me, for me, weren't funny enough. And people have said it's the funniest film. Someone somewhere said it's the funniest type of this film since Airplane. I don't think that's true.
Nigel thinks it's super fly. Boyd, more medium fly. Let's move on to a film that I think has been talked about on this show for close to a year. M. Night Shyamalan's The Last Airbender 3D.
Yeah, do you remember when it was announced that Avatar was announced, James Cameron's Avatar? And this originally is based on a Nickelodeon animated series called Avatar: The Last Airbender. And there was talk, you know, who was going to drop the Avatar in it? There was talk, it was a big rival to Avatar. And that this, you know, would M. Night Shyamalan, who's written and directed this film, agree to drop the Avatar element? Well, he has. There was then excitement that Dev Patel, our very own, not Radio 5 Lives, but Britain's Dev Patel from Slumdog Millionaire and Skins is going to be in it, and he is in it. And it was very exciting. He's in a big Hollywood film made by the guy, you know, by this great director, M. Night Shyamalan. And we're all very, very excited. Then word came through, I think, early this year when it started, you know, people started to see it in America, that maybe it wasn't that good. This film, I think, has the worst buzz of any major Hollywood, in quotes, blockbuster for years and years and years, perhaps since M. Night Shyamalan's own The Happening, which had terrible buzz. Now, I have to say, we'll set it up. It is about this strange kind of alternate version of the Earth where there are four regions, each, you know, fire, water, air, and whatever the other one
Earth.
Is. Earth, thank you. And there are these benders, and they are called benders, we have to say that, who can bend these different elements to their will. So they can literally manipulate water before our very eyes, or Earth, or whatever. And this is the first in a projected trilogy focusing on the kind of water world, which takes over the main body of the film. And Dev Patel is kind of a villain, really. He's the son of one of the kings of this world, and he's basically is very irritated by this youngster who comes along, who is the Avatar, who's the only one left in the whole world who control all of these things, in theory. So Dev Patel is very angry with this little boy and kind of wants to utilize him to do evil, as we hear in this clip.
You are my prisoner, Airbender. I'm taking you back to the Fire Nation.
You said I...
I apologize. I should have explained further. If you failed the test, as all others did, you were free to leave. But as it turns out, you are the only one in the entire world who could pass this test. It is truly an honor to be in your presence. Don't even try to escape.
Yeah, so that was kind of an example of the not particularly good dialogue in this film. Now, I want to say, first of all, I'm an M. Night Shyamalan fan, believe it or not, still. And I think, you know, certainly to start with, he was a great talent. He had a similar storytelling and visual style to Spielberg. I think he owed a lot to Spielberg. I even quite like The Happening, which was one of the films which he got hugely slated for. I think it's a well-made, interesting effort to do a kind of alternative kind of horror film. I think it's an interesting failure. Lady in the Water was absolutely terrible, and that was like this kind of weird fable where he created his own magical world set around a swimming pool in an apartment block, and he starred in it, and it was everything about it was pretty bad. So I'm kind of, in a way, I'm rooting for him. I kind of feel sorry for him because the buzz about this film has been so bad. But we have to say the buzz is right. It is unbelievably tedious. That's the thing about it. You know, it, unlike say Step Up 3D, which is funny and it has stuff about being born from a boombox that we can all laugh at and enjoy and laugh along with it, this is just unutterably boring. And it's just, it's been retrofitted with 3D, but because he makes films anyway in a kind of slightly gloomy, slightly pretentious for, you know, family films and for mainstream films way, it's the gloomiest 3D you've ever seen in your life. Whereas Step Up 3D is really vibrant and bouncy and fun, this is just miserably gloomy and dull 3D, and it's totally pointless and shouldn't have been done. But they're selling the film entirely on the 3D. The adverts are literally, it's all about the 3D, and yet it's completely pointless. It's the first 5 minutes of the film where they're trying to explain what the hell is going on with these different worlds is incoherent, and it gets even more incoherent as it goes on. The effects are bad. You know, this is a film that costs, again, about $150 million. It just looks rubbish. It looks like a film that could have been made 20 years ago, to me, apart from the endless use of CGI. The characters are dull. Poor Dev Patel stranded in a very kind of tedious, repetitive... He says the same thing constantly as being the villain. You know, he does his best with it. And the little boy in it, the main character, this character who's supposed to have all... The only one in the world who has all these powers to manipulate all of these elements, isn't a very good actor. You know, I don't like criticising some poor little boy. He's probably only 8, 9, 10 years old. But he's terrible. He just speaks in a monotone... the other thing is, M. Night Shyamalan has taken the decision. In the original, they are Asian characters, you know, Japanese. They're visibly of that world, of the anime world. It's kind of... The whole thing is kind of a tribute to anime, even though it's an American show. For some reason, M. Night Shyamalan has cast white actors in these roles. You know, even then, he's kind of ruined the whole point, or one of the points, of the original show. I think fans of the original show, which apparently there are legion, are going to be devastated by how bad this film is.
Because it showed on Nickelodeon.
Yeah,
in
and it
2005.
Was one of Nickelodeon's biggest hits. You know, ran for 3 series, huge in America, not quite so huge here, but I think people whose kids watch Nickelodeon will know of it. And, you know, kids will be there, oh, yeah, I really want to see the film, the live-action version of this thing, because I'm excited by it. And they're going to be absolutely mortified by the sheer dullness of it. It's so awfully, incredibly... It's the dullest film I've seen for many, many months, if not years.
We've heard what Boyd Hilton has made of The Last Airbender. Let's find out what Nigel Floyd makes of it.
Pretty much the same, actually. I mean, the problem with it is you would think it had a built-in audience because of the success and the cult reputation of the Nickelodeon TV series, which I'm also assuming must be available on DVD. then you've got that audience built in. They are the ones who are most upset about this film. They're the ones who are saying it's a travesty. The original had lots of sort of Buddhist philosophy in it. There were lots of sort of allegorical meanings that they thought were very profound, and they loved it. Now, you've got to bear in mind, however, that the majority of people who watch Nickelodeon are of a tender age. So they're probably between the ages of, say, 6 and 12. That's the demographic you're talking about. So there's a level of mock profundity, as it were, in the film, which is the worst thing about it. But there's this kind of cod Buddhist tosh in the film, which is absolutely excruciating. I mean, everything is portentous when it should be profound. It's kind of laughable when it should be funny. It's action-packed, but it's never exciting. The lead character is a complete vacuum. I mean, he's like an empty space on the screen. There's nothing going on there at all. Clearly, the younger viewers are supposed to identify with this brother and sister, Katara and her brother Sokka. They're the ones who discover Aang, who's this kind of avatar character who's supposed to be able to control all four elements. He's been locked in an ice sphere for 100 years. Meanwhile, the world has got out of joint and the fire people have taken over with their fire machines. But the worst thing of all is the floaty, furry cat animal thing, which is absolutely mind-bogglingly terrible. I mean, it's
from the Neverending Story. You've seen the Neverending Story. It's the same kind of thing, but they did it better in the Neverending Story.
I like the Neverending Story.
The Neverending Story is fine. Yeah, it's about 1,000,000,000 times better than The Last Airbender in 3D.
Yes, in 3D, in retrofitted 3D. How many times are we having to say that now? But it is particularly excruciating
Question is, after having seen it, is has a major director, you know, M. Night Shyamalan, The Sixth Sense, a great film, and he's done, you know, I think probably 3 or 4 really good films, has ever such a major director fallen from grace so woefully? I mean, it's actually incompetent. I thought the storytelling, the way it cuts from one scene to another, incoherent. It's an absolutely incompetent.
So it's actually badly made.
It's a badly made film. It's a badly written, badly acted, badly made film. Has ever a major director done such an awfully, terribly incompetent piece of
work? His last four films have been The Village, Lady in the Water, The Happening, and now The Last Airbender. Yeah. That
I don't
stinks.
Think. Well, I think The Village and The Happening aren't too bad. I think they're I think they're both competent films. You know, you watch those, and all right, there are things about them that are wrong. Lady in the Water was embarrassing and inept and kind of stupid, but still quite well made. This is terribly made. I think badly made. It looks rubbish. It looks awful.
But it's taken $130 million in the US, which makes it its biggest film since Signs back in 2002.
Yeah, but it cost $150 million, so it's not going to make a profit unless it does really well on DVD.
Reese and Usk has texted in saying, you know a film's going to be bad when the whole audience watching the trailer bursts out laughing at the name. How much of a problem does the whole bending business actually cause when you're watching the film?
It is a problem. There is a line, I think, where he says, we must deprive the benders of their resources. And you think, it sounds a bit like Section 28. You know, they've got to get these gay people and take away their resources. I mean, it is excruciating. Thing about the film, which is really important, is you want it to be as funny as The Last Airbender makes it sound, but it's not. Yeah. Boyd is right. It's just dull, dull, dull. It's dull to look at, it's dull to listen to, it's dull to experience, and it goes on for an eternity, even though it's less than 2 hours. And most movies now are like 2.25, 2.5 hours. This is the longest film that I've seen this year.
Last thing on it, you said it was a trilogy. Will parts 2 and 3 ever get made?
I will be astonished and amazed if parts 2 and 3 ever get made.
Let's move on to Le Refuge.
That's you, Boyd.
Oh, yeah, it's me, Le Refuge. Yeah, well, Le Refuge is the new film from François Ozon, who is a kind of very important kind of cult figure, I think. He's a kind of French director. Probably the film he's most famous for here is Swimming Pool, which I thought was a really, really good, interesting film, which came out a few years ago. His last couple of films haven't been released here because they've been so odd. I think the last one was about a baby or a child that sprouted wings and started flying about and was so weird they didn't release it. This one is much more accessible and is basically about, it's a woman who is, right at the beginning of the film, there are, I warn people, very, very intense scenes of drug taking. And this starts off with a couple who are both taking drugs at the same time. The man in the couple dies, leaving her on her own, and he's just made her pregnant. you then flash forward a bit to she's fully pregnant, and the actress in the film was really pregnant. So it's a rare example of she's not wearing a ridiculous prosthetic belly. She's really pregnant, which makes the whole film much more believable. The guy, the dead guy's brother, comes along to stay with her, and she's kind of renting this house, if you like, in the countryside. His gay brother, he meets her kind of guy handyman, and they form a relationship. And it's kind of about how this pregnant woman, who's recovering from the death of her lover, who she really, really loved, and is dealing with all these kinds of issues and is having a baby, finds this new family, really, with this brother. And it's very slow. It's very, very French. There are long scenes of people going out and having a cigarette. And not, they don't really do much else. They just stand there smoking, looking out, looking about them and wondering what's going on in their lives and being very French. I liked it. I'm a big fan of Francois Ozon. I think he's a very talented... He's a maverick. So in his films, characters do things you don't expect them to do, and they end up in situations that people regard as being ridiculous in a way. And this has an ending that will have people talking, would that really happen? Would she really do that? I don't want to give it away, but it's very interesting. I was interested all the way through, even though it's got a pretty slow pace and scenes go on for a long time, like they do in subtitled French art house films. But I thought it was really good and well worth seeing if it's showing as a cinema near you.
I didn't like it anything like as much, I have to say. I do like... There are a number of his films that other people might have seen. Under the Sand is a film with Charlotte Rampling. She falls asleep on the beach while her husband goes in for a swim and he disappears. So it's a film about grief. He's obsessed with grief and also with people coming to terms with breakdowns of relationships. So 5x2, for example, was about one of the best films ever about the breakdown of a relationship told in reverse. Swing Pool was a slightly lighter sort of piece. This one I didn't like. It was irredeemably bourgeois in the way that the French can be, you know. So the couple overdosed, not in a kind of squalid little room. They overdosed in a very, very nice room that is the second house owned by his mother. And
the
so
interiors
on and so
are
forth.
Lovely.
I wasn't there for it at all, I have to say.
But you must admit, Isabelle Carré, let's name check her, as the main character, Moose, she's called Moose, as in chocolate mousse, is brilliant, I thought, and properly pregnant, and she does all this stuff. She has to go to a nightclub and dance, and she does it all whilst being quite heavily pregnant. She is fantastic.
Yeah, oddly enough, that was the one scene she didn't do pregnant. It's weird.
Oh, really?
It's a weird thing. It's one of those lovely little things. It's going to be a quiz question in years to come. She does the whole film pregnant, but when she tried to do the dancing scene pregnant, she just couldn't do the dancing. So when they came back and they did the bits of the film at the beginning and the end where she's no longer pregnant, then they had to come back and do the little dance scene. That is a nice scene, and there are a couple of kind of good things in it, but it's one of those films that's kind of wanting you to think that it's more profound than it is. It's leaving you a lot of space to read stuff into it, and I didn't think it was necessarily there.
I was moved. Colin.
Tell you what, that's going to be a quiz question. That is one tough quiz. No. We've got two films to go, one with subtitles, one made by Disney. Let's do the subtitle one first, The Secret in Their Eyes.
The Secret in Their Eyes is the film which was nominated and won the Oscar for the Best Foreign Film in 2010. Now, the film which everyone says, and I agree with them, should have won, was Michael Haneke's White Ribbon.
So, or A Prophet.
Or A Prophet. I thought A Prophet should have won.
Yeah, well, I'm sticking with White Ribbon.
But this was the winner.
The question is it that good? I think in many, many ways it is. I mean, the story starts off in a way quite conventionally. There's a character who used to work in the legal department. We're in Argentina. For many, many years, he's now sort of retired. He's been haunted by this particular case, this Morales case, in which a young woman was brutally raped and murdered. And the investigation into it was rather messy, and there were a lot of sort of loose ends left there. He's now decided he's going to write a novel about it. That's the kind of conventional element of it. So he's gone back, and he meets again the woman, a very, very beautiful woman, who was his superior in the legal department at that time. And he says, I'm going to try and reconstruct. I'm going to dig into this case. There's something unresolved about it for me. One of the things that's unresolved about it is the fact that he was, in fact, in love with this woman, who is quite a bit younger than him, quite a lot richer than him, completely out of his league, and operates in a whole sort of different world. And then the whole film starts to become about memory, in a sense. And that's what the film really homes in on. And I loved the way that it continued to unfold, because there are several quite conventional thriller elements to it. It's quite Hitchcockian in a lot of ways. There's some political undertow, because it's in the 70s. and there's a lot going on politically in the country at that time. There's a sort of a right-wing clampdown, and it manages to kind of balance all these things. At the end, I felt it got a little bit too conventional, but I thought while it was going on, there was never a moment when I wasn't involved.
I really liked it. There's one scene in this film which begins with a helicopter crane shot of a football stadium right in the distance, and the tracking shot goes right honing in on one character in this football stadium, absolutely packed with 70,000 people, and it carries on going, this shot, until he chases another character out of the stadium. It's an incredible tour de force sequence, one of the best tour de force sequences since, like, you know, the days of Brian De Palma was doing this kind of thing in Snake Eyes. Not a particularly good film.
But great opening.
Great opening, exactly. And this is absolutely spectacular. And it almost comes from nowhere, because the film visually, it's good, it's nice, but this sequence is amazing. And I think it's worth the price of entry alone. It's absolutely stunning. And it's a very compelling, enjoyable police procedural, I think. I think the rest of it, I kind of didn't quite go along with all the it trying to be heavy, all the themes. It's a little bit pretentious for me, but it is a very entertaining kind of murder mystery, really.
Thank you for your Airbender texts already. Roxy in Manchester says, took the kids 5 and 7 to see it this morning. They loved it. I nearly fell asleep. We were all impressed by the special effects, but that was all for me. The kids would rather watch the animated version. And Russell says, I'm sure the film is bad, but I want it known the cartoon is amazing. A classic. Well, as anonymous person says, Saturday night ruined already. Taking son to see Airbender. Tickets bought already. We have about 50 seconds to do Tinkerbell and the Great Fairy Rescue.
Curious thing about Tinkerbell and the Great Fairy Rescue is there are two previous films, both of which came out on DVD, Tinkerbell and Tinkerbell and the Lost Treasure. This is a third in a series, but this one, bizarrely, is coming out theatrically and then going to DVD quite quickly. I don't know what they think they've got here that makes it sort of worthy of a theatrical release, but if you have got a daughter aged between, say, 4 and 10, they probably will buy into this. It's a nice little thing. It's very well animated. Apparently John Lasseter from Pixar had some sort of input into the sort of creative elements. The fairies do look oddly Botoxed in some of the scenes. I mean, it's a CGI animation, but it's quite odd that sometimes they look a little bit too shiny, but I kind of liked it despite myself.
Friday night and your £10, what film do you go and see?
I'd say The Secret in Their Eyes.
Yeah, The Secret in Their Eyes, unquestionably.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live. bbc.co.uk/5live.